if a meeting is being held.
Girl, KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at Tonic Lounge in Portland. Next Level 3.0 is a collaboration with Flawless Shade, the House of Flora, and the House of Ada, featuring KBOO's Dina B and DJ Gila River Monster, and more DJs and performers. Costumes are highly recommended. Again, that's Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at the Tonic Lounge, 3100 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty and welcome to Voices from the Edge. I am thrilled to have in the studio with me today, Gentry Agiza. Yay, I got it right. She is a Kenya peace activist and social change agent. She's the director of Transforming Communities for Social Change and coordinator of Friends Church Peace Teams in Kenya. She will be the program for healing and rebuilding our communities, Lessons from Kenya, this Friday, June 16th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, located at 4312 Southeast Stark. And I will give you that information several times and post it on my Facebook page. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It is a pleasure to have you here, and I can't wait to jump into the conversation. And so you are described as a peace activist. What got you involved in peace activism?
I think my life taught me a lot about peace.
So tell me a little bit about growing up in Kenya.
I was brought up in a polygamous family, but my dad passed away when I was 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you know, polygamy is like the first wife is the decision maker for the rest of the things.
Right.
And then I saw my mother's pain growing up.
Uh-huh.
She was a loving mother.
Right.
And I honor her because she kind of looked at the suffering, mm-hmm. beyond the suffering, and raised us to be people we will be.
Wow.
And I think at a moment I was brought up with a lot of anger and some fear in me.
Right.
But then I discovered I had to make a decision with my life and pick what is good for me and not suffer my mother's pain because I was taking that trend. So I had a turning point in 2003.
Ah.
And that's when I started to do peace work, mostly doing trainings on Alternative to Violence program, which is a community-based training.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., it's mostly done in prisons.
Mm.
I think they're opening up to community. But in Kenya in 2003, when it started, we thought, okay, well, this is better in community because it's from the community people go to prison.
Right.
So for me, I think that program was a turning point.
Mm.
I learned my lessons and decided to be who I am and chose to look at who are these other people who are closed into emotions that define other people's life.
Right.
We kind hold other people's pain and we want to hit back because of that.
Yes.
We get stuck in our personal suffering instead of looking at what we are expecting to get.
Right.
Everybody wakes up in the morning to want a bright side of life.
Right.
And so that's what I look at and that's why I'm here.
And wow. So tell me, as a child growing up in Kenya, you know, America is very ignorant about anything outside of our borders. And so we don't know a lot personally about Kenya. What can you describe what it was like growing up in Kenya as a child?
Compared to the U.S.?
Well, no. I just want you to tell me from Kenya.
Being a Kenya.
Yeah, just
okay.
From Kenya.
Growing up as a Kenya was kind of a very lovely experience.
Mm-hmm.
You are brought up in a family surrounding,
mm-hmm.
we have aunts and cousins who are in-laws to your mother or cousins to your mother, relatives stay with you. Mm. And so you kind of honor everybody as a parent, and you are raised and disciplined with them.
Yes.
And
yes.
So there is that community in you as you grow up, mm-hmm. and you also look at reaching out to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about just being sensitive with discipline,
mm-hmm.
I remember I was walking on the street sometime when I was, I think, the age of 12, and this stranger, like just a man on the road, saw me walking back home from school, and it wasn't time to go home.
Right.
And I was like, what's wrong with you? I'm not right. in school. And then he got involved more to take me back to school and ask the teachers, why are you sending this girl out? I mean, that was kind of Kenya life we were growing in, being more concerned about each and
everybody,
one of us.
Yeah. Right. Well, your experience and mine aren't that different. I grew up in Baltimore, right? Big city, predominantly black population.
Yeah.
And the community raised the kids. So every mm-hmm. adult in the community was responsible for the kids. And just like that man stopped you on the road, mm-hmm. I had the woman up the street. What are you doing here? Does your mom know you're up here?
Yeah.
Right? And she'd be on the phone calling my mom before I got home, right? So
yeah.
I love that, right?
Yeah.
Because the community had this sense that we're all in it together,
yeah.
right? And so were there wars happening in Kenya during the time that you were growing up?
Until 2008, we have been a very peaceful country.
Mm-hmm.
2007, 2008, Kenya is a 42-tribe society
right.
with different cultures, but we have some common cultures,
mm-hmm.
two national languages, English and Swahili. In 2008, we experienced post-election violence.
Mm.
And it wasn't, I mean, the world could define it as election-related violence.
Right.
But I think for me, as a peacemaker and working with these people, it was really like you were sitting on a time bomb for so long after the independence, and people needed to vent.
Right.
They just needed to get on that.
Mm-hmm.
But then I and a team of other friends and even different organizations played a major role to look at how reconciliation can work at our unstable time.
Right.
And so we focused even up to 2013 to try and make sure that we have a peaceful election, but also just cohesiveness.
Mm-hmm.
We can all agree.
Right.
We differ in some things, but we don't take it like it should be a bridge between ourselves
mm-hmm.
in the country. But we still have to be reminded about peace every now and then, because we are talking about emotions.
Yes.
And we're talking about people being triggered. And
yes.
it can happen anytime, as much as you want to have peace.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right. And are you working intergenerationally, so with young kids and with adults and with elders? Who are the folks that you are working with when you're doing your training?
We work with mostly youth and adults.
Mm-hmm.
We are also, right now, we are working with finding ways of involving young children so that they grow up looking at a peaceful nation.
Yes, yes.
In 2008, mostly the blame was on the youth, because in Kenyan population, majority of the youth are unemployed.
Oh, yes.
They are so idle.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can be manipulated and be used in any way.
Right.
And so the violence was mostly perpetrated by the youth. Not because they started it, but they were influenced, they were pushed
right.
into it.
Right.
And so we are looking, we focus more on youth at that side,
mm-hmm.
because you're like, any election coming, they are also vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make them think of what do they do with their time and
right.
energy?
And tell me, let me invite callers to call in. I could sit here and talk to you myself all day, but that would not be appropriate. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. If you've just joined me, I am in conversation with Gentry Agiza. And she will be speaking at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House tomorrow, Friday, June 16th at 7 p.m. There's a potluck, community potluck, starting at 6. And the address is 4312 Southeast Stark. And so tell me specifically about the training program. And so are there volunteers or people required to go because they've been in trouble before? How do you create the team that you're training?
Right now, we are working mostly in a region called Mount Elgon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a region that has experienced land clashes. People, two clans are fighting over land rights. And so there's been a lot of human rights violation and, I mean, women's assaults and children violation. And so we kind of just invite the community that you're doing a program and tell them that we have slots for 20 people because the workshop is so intense. You can't deal with more than 20 people. And then you have a team of 27 facilitators who experience in the trainings we do. The Alternative to Violence, another one is called Healing and Building a Community, which was adopted from Rwanda after the genocide, but tried to be put in the context of the Kenyan situation. And so we invite people who are open, they sign up, and then we start the training as a normal day.
And it's a one-day training or is it
3 days?
Three days.
But then there's always some, especially for the trauma healing training, there are a lot of follow-ups. Like right now, we are working with perpetrators and victims in this community to start up a community integration, which is taking a long, long process.
Yes, when people are injured and in pain, right? You have to deal with the pain first, right? Because you can't get them to think about the future until you resolve that.
They can't be productive. I mean, and peace is a very, very risky and expensive thing.
So it sounds like you put yourself into situations that are not comfortable situations. And how do you prepare yourself, right? Because clearly this is an emotional, passionate thing for you, right? This you bring your whole heart to this work. How do you prepare yourself to go in and create these kind of opportunities for people to heal and then take on really working in a way that builds community and builds peace? How do you prepare yourself for that work?
I have a loving family. I have a 12-year, 4-year-old and one under 8-month girl. And a husband who is really supportive.
Wonderful. That helps.
So, I mean, I kind of appreciate that. And also the pool of facilitators we work with are very supportive people. There are some who go to the field to do the trainings and others are not allocated. So when we come back, the others are always as a backup for us. And I think for me, I believe in people, humanity having an existence, and I cannot exist if you're not there.
That's right.
As the Ubuntu spirit says, I am because you are, and so I am. I mean, so if you are suffering in sadness, it saddens me too. But how can we together make a healing journey and deal with issues we are dealing with?
Powerful, powerful words. You know what I'm fascinated by is I don't know how much you've been able to read about what's been happening in the U.S., right? And we are at a place in this country where violence is becoming the norm. And hatred and anti-everybody, right? It's like everybody, whether you're an immigrant or refugee, whether you're black. And so we are at this very tense time in this country where it doesn't feel like people are listening to each other. People aren't creating spaces to have differences of opinion. And what advice would you give us based on your experience?
Interesting. My thoughts will be we are living today and we are alive because it's where we are. And fear doesn't count. That's point number one. I mean, if we get scared, then we give the enemy the power to destroy us completely. But community and being together is one of the things we need to count on as we go towards this journey. Let us also understand how far people have come, where we came from, and look at our historical paths. And start looking at where did the rain start beating us. And as a community, we work towards reconciling that. Just with an open mind and remove all the judgments and doubts. Once we start saying them versus us, we are divided among ourselves. And once we say it doesn't matter them or us, we are all going to get into this. And so that will be the journey.
Well, I think we're challenged because at our highest levels of our government, we have people expounding hate and fear, right? And hate and fear, as you well know, is an extremely motivating factor, right? And so we have people hating people that they've never met, right? And we have a president who's saying that's okay, right? To hate people that you've never met, to hate people because they look different, because they talk different, right? Because they worship different. And we don't seem to have leadership at the highest levels of our government to counter that. Mm-hmm. So I am fascinated by people who've been on this journey before, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. And who have found paths to bring different sides together. Yeah. Now, in Kenya, though the ethnicity is the same, as you said, how many tribes? 42 tribes. Mm-hmm. So you've got different cultural norms. You've mm-hmm. got different community norms, mm-hmm. Depending upon where you are in Kenya.
Yeah.
And so it's not the racial differences that we have, but it's certainly cultural differences, religious differences, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And we haven't done a good job yet of trying to figure out how we bring those sides together.
Hmm.
Now, politically in Kenya, how many political parties are there?
We have, right now, we had a lot of
political parties.
Until, I think, right now, as you're going to election in August uh-huh. this year, on the 8th, we have some small political parties who have joined together to make coalitions. So we have like two
mm-hmm.
powerful coalitions. Right. Actually, one is more now registered a political party with so many political small parties,
right.
But one is more standing like a coalition, which each voices has still a decision.
Right.
And then we have some independents.
Mm-hmm.
And it will amaze you to know that after the primaries in Kenya, we have so many independent, over 5,000 independent candidates who are
wow.
coming to the list.
Wow.
Yeah. And we are just like, are we expecting to have a booklet?
Wow.
It'll be interesting to see that.
Yes. And so why does politics lead to potential community violence? Why do elections lead to community violence?
One is if political aspirant party members are willing to go tribal,
mm-hmm.
it becomes my tribe versus your tribe,
Our
son versus your son,
mm-hmm.
and that will bring a big clash because as much as we have 42 tribes, Kenya is the size of Texas.
Mm, okay.
And so the size of Texas with 42 tribes, and we're talking about over 43 million people.
In a very small geographic area.
Yeah, and these people are intermarrying. You can live anywhere in the country. You can buy land anywhere. So
right.
at a point, somebody who is a perpetrator is always a victim to another side. Yeah.
Again, if you're just joining the conversation, I am speaking with Gentry
Agiza,
and she is a Kenya peace activist and social change agent, and she's been here for about a week and unfortunately leaves on Sunday, but you will have an opportunity to hear from her tomorrow at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, and the conversation will be Healing and Rebuilding Our Communities. The number to call if you want to join the conversation is 503-231-8187.
Yeah.
And so what are the misperceptions that people in the U.S. have about Kenya? I've got a couple just because of my trip, but mm-hmm. I'd love to hear from you. What do you think the misperceptions are?
There's always looking at Kenya as a fast-growing country,
mm-hmm.
which is well appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
I think the relationship is trying to strongly bond
mm-hmm.
that I haven't had a lot of them.
Right.
And so I think in my field of work and the people I work, because I work with communities and American communities in Kenya, vis-a-vis working with government in America
uh-huh.
and government
right,
in Kenya. So
right.
for me, it might be very different.
Yes,
see a lot of connection and the American families trying to work with Kenyan people in mm. supporting their programs and working with them.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say that there is any that I know of.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you a secret, right?
Yeah.
I think most Americans think that Kenya is still all jungle. There's no urban center. There are no high rises.
I haven't had that.
Right?
I haven't.
I trust me on this, right? I America's just, because they just don't know, right? It's not that we just don't know. We're not exposed to.
But one thing you need to know is Kenya is a very beautiful country.
Absolutely.
With a lot
beautiful.
Of national parks and yes. national, I mean, still natural forests.
Yes,
and
yes. A lot of green space, a lot
yeah.
of open. Yes.
And
yes.
a very friendly.
And very
community.
Friendly. Yes, I almost got arrested when I was in Kenya. Because the I was with the military, I was with the U.S. Navy, mm-hmm. and I was walking with a group of friends from the ship, right? And we were just playing around, having a good time, and I was pushing this guy down the street, right? And this Kenya police officer walks up to me and starts speaking to me in Swahili, and
uh-huh.
I didn't know what he was talking about, and
assist
I put
and
my
a
hands
brother.
Up, and I went, excuse me, you know? And he went, are you American? And I said, yes, and do you have ID? And I said, yes. And I showed him my ID. And he said, well, you look like you were from this tribe. And this tribe's been messing with the military people when they come
oh,
down.
No.
And it just touched my heart, right? Because I was like, I'm home, right?
Yeah.
Because people are looking at me thinking, you belong here, right? This is where you are from. And as, you know, as someone born in the U.S., mm-hmm. I have no idea about my ancestry, right? Mm-hmm. And so that always stuck with me, right? I was like, I could have ended up in jail in Kenya.
Interesting.
As a 19-year-old. I loved my time in Kenya. And I was telling you just before we went on the air about my experience when the ship pulled in mm-hmm. to Mombasa, Kenya, and we looked out over the bow and there were like black people for miles,
mm-hmm.
miles and miles and miles. And I get down off the ship and a brother walks up to me and says, welcome home, sister. You've been gone 200
interesting,
years.
Interesting, yeah.
I was in tears. I was absolutely in tears. Oh. And I was treated like family. Everywhere I went,
yeah.
people wanted to know everything about me, everything about the U.S.
Right? I think that is like a country culture.
Yes, yes, yes.
Guests are always well taken care of.
Well taken care of. And I felt guilty many times because I thought people were being hospitable to me mm-hmm. and providing me resources that they needed themselves, right? But they were so gracious. You're a guest. You got to eat with us. Mm-hmm. You got to come and see the family. You got to do. And I did it all. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I would have stayed in Kenya.
Interesting.
The Navy would have let me. I have always been a student of Dr. Martin Luther King, who espoused nonviolent direct action. As you know, in the U.S., black people have been fighting for their civil rights, for equality, for the whole 400 years that we've been here.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had different levels of success depending upon who's in office, what laws have been passed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're still at this place where even though we no longer have laws on the books that mm-hmm. prohibit black people from owning property or living mm-hmm. in certain areas or being educated in certain areas, when we look at the quality of life, we mm-hmm. find that people of black people specifically, but all people of color, still are not equal when it comes to equal opportunity, equal access to education, home ownership, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so we in the U.S. have been working at this under this philosophy from Dr. Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I have organized my entire life, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's always been bringing a diverse group of people together, having an agreement that this is nonviolent, that it's family friendly, that it should be all ages. That's how I've organized using those principles. Not everybody likes those principles, right? Because people think, you know, it takes too long, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've been doing this for 200 years and it's not, you know, it hasn't quite worked yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say about just that kind of conflict, right? Because really, I mean, you know, I mean, I think if we took up arms, clearly there would be a lot of deaths, there'd be a lot of harm. But this philosophy of nonviolent, is that how you also, I mean, I know that you're a peace activist, so clearly you're teaching people about nonviolence. So does Dr. King and Gandhi and other peace activists from our past really influence the work that you do?
A lot of the work I do is influenced, especially with Martin Luther King and probably Mahatma Gandhi too. I have a lot of their books I do read. I'm a peace activist, but not just a peace activist. I'm just a non-violent peace activist.
Okay.
And I do trainings to help people to petition if there's a structural violence.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I wish I had a paper to draw you, I mean, there's something called a speedometer, which is a tool we use. You want to have half of the section of your process, you have to make sure that all your allies are intact. And then you look at what are the methods to win your opponents.
Yes.
And so every opponent who comes in, make sure you maintain your group and don't lose any.
Right.
And why people fail in nonviolence is when they have division among themselves. That gives the opponent power to destroy us.
To divide and conquer.
That's when you find nonviolence is taking too long because somebody gets impatient and they want to get out. And yet it has to be pulled together. Because when somebody gets out, they leak information of your plan. And then the opponent knows and gets ready to plan to attack back.
That's right.
So for me, I think it's more of keeping together.
And that's the hard part. That's the hard part.
Yeah, it's very difficult because, as you're saying, people lose patience and say, we've been doing this for all along, but why are we doing it?
Right.
It's not because of us. It's because of the kids we have.
Yes.
And I speak to women. Like when I speak, every time I speak to women, these men are our children. They are our sons.
That's right.
Our husbands are our firstborns.
Right.
I say that.
Right.
And for me, it's, we are blessed because we have been given a very special gift since we were born. We have tolerance and we can handle patience. And that means for the change to happen, we have to take up our lead.
Right.
Be the best mothers we are. Be the best women we are.
Oh, man, I could listen to you talk all day. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. I would love to. And so it sounds like you, your trip here, and then you're going to San Francisco when you leave here?
Yeah, on Sunday.
And what are you going to do in San Francisco?
I've been in the U.S. for over 1.5 months.
One and a half months?
Yeah, I mean, I was in Virginia, in Harrisonburg, then I went to Rochester, then I went to New York, I was in Baltimore.
Oh, you're in my hometown.
Yeah, and then
I
went to Washington, D.C. and came to Santa Barbara.
Oh, nice.
And came here. So I'm going to San Francisco for 8 days. Then I go to Kalamazoo, Wichita for 3 days. Then I'll go to, to Kalamazoo. And then I go to Wichita for 2 weeks before I go back to Kenya.
Wow.
So I'm still in the U.S. I'm on a speaking tour.
I see.
And doing fundraising for Transforming Community for Social Change to do peace building. Yeah.
And you do your work through faith-based organizations or do you just partner with faith-based organizations?
I partner with faith-based organizations, but I have an organization that I'm a founder, which is more on reconciliation and peace building, but also does nonviolence direct action.
And so that's the NGO that you have?
A non-governmental organization in Kenya, yeah.
See, I know about those NGOs.
You are home.
Right. And so, wow, that's a long time to be away from home.
Yeah.
And it's a lot, and it's, you're going to so many different communities. So what have you noticed in your travels so far in the U.S.? I mean, clearly people know you're coming, right? And they're preparing for you and you're doing presentations. But have you had an opportunity to really interact with people in all the various communities that you've been in?
Every place I go, I try to pick up a conversation. Some people attend my talks and we have side talks after that.
Right.
And it's been encouraging so far. And in Baltimore, I had a meeting, a one-day meeting with refugees. And then yesterday, 2 days ago, the day before yesterday and yesterday, we were doing a training with, I guess it's immigrants in here and community. And it was a wonderful training, just seeing on how these people are trying to bring the threads together.
Yes.
And the Max incident was discussed.
Oh, yes.
Sorry for lost lives.
Yes, yes.
And they keep encouraging the girls that there is a lesson to learn from it.
Yes, it is.
How do we love without hitting back on hate?
Yes. I think that's, and you know, you're right. It was such a tragic event that didn't have to happen. Mm-hmm. And it is my hope that as we continue to investigate, we find out why our public safety system continues to fail in those kind of incidents. Because there was an incident the night before. I don't know if people told you about that.
I didn't know that.
But on Thursday night, there was an African-American woman attacked on the MAX train. A 42-year-old African-American woman, exact same man. Wow. And the police did not arrest him. And they did not believe the black woman who said that she had been attacked by him on the train. And so for me, that's like the bigger story. And it's not something that the media has focused on. And of course, we want to honor the men who lost their lives because they were really brave men who stepped in when they didn't have to and didn't even think about it. Just stepped in to protect those girls, right? Yeah. And it took the man who was injured to say, the girls need help, right? Don't keep sending me money. Send it to the girls. The girls need help because they will need counseling. They will need community support for a long time. Yeah. I just can't imagine the guilt that they walk around with, right? Through no fault of their own.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it was a tragic, tragic situation. But in my mind, one that didn't have to happen because of the ineffectiveness of our law enforcement to do their job.
You're
and
right.
that, not just the day before, but even a month before. So so we've got more work to do to figure out why that happened.
Yeah.
Yes. I think we might have a caller. But before we go to the phone line, have you had an opportunity to, you said you were talking to immigrants and refugees and did some training with them while you were here. I don't know if you've had a chance to visit Africa House.
No.
No? Well, maybe you can twist somebody's arm to get you over
get
to Africa
there.
House because they would love, love, love to have you come in and spend some time.
Okay.
They used to be a program of IRCLO, the Immigrant Refugee Organization of a coalition, I guess, IRCO? Immigrant Refugee Community Organization. And they started their own nonprofit, so they're now their own independent organization.
Oh, interesting.
And they're doing some fabulous work, and they have a lot of young Kenyan men, boys and girls, who go to that center and spend a lot of time there. So I think, A, they would love to see you, and B, I think you would both get a lot out of that process.
That's interesting.
So again, the number to call is 503-231-8187. And so you were talking about, you've spent a lot of time in the U.S., you've had some one-on-one conversations with folks, and have done more traveling than many people in the U.S. have done in the U.S., I should say. Any analysis based on all the communities that you've spoken to so far about kind of, I think maybe you have a very, of course, welcoming audience, right? Because people are coming
Thank
to
you.
See you, right? So that's probably different.
Yeah.
But have you had any negative experiences since you've been in the U.S.?
I wouldn't say negative experience. I mean, I don't know what negative means in this situation, but I'll think that what I've experienced being in U.S. is there's a lot of tension.
Yes.
Kind of a deep fear of uncertainty.
Yes.
And every place I go, I keep telling the American people I meet, pull together.
Pull together.
Because we are kind of getting ourselves inherit.
Yes.
Other people's sorrowness and sadness, and that's not our portion. Our portion is to live for tomorrow.
Right.
So the more we pull together and realize what we are doing to ourselves about everything that is happening in the country, then we realize what solution we are talking about.
Right.
But I mean, there's a lot of fear and tension.
Yes. That is absolutely true. I feel that and hear it, and from pretty much across the board. Because I think what's really sad is we have now school children going to school that are being yelled all kind of really nasty things at them as they go to and from school. And of course, I'm a child of the 60s, so the civil rights movement was hot and heavy when I was growing up. And mm-hmm. I constantly asked my parents, why? Because TV was new. And evening news, we would all circle around the TV and see people that look like you and I being brutalized by the police and dogs. And why? Because they were trying to register to vote, or they were trying to get into an education institution, or they were trying to buy a home in a neighborhood where they were not welcome. So my growing up years, it was always, why? This is not fair, right? And my mom and dad were really good at having those kind of political conversations. And my mom said, you know, you treat people the way you want to be treated. Most people are good. My dad, however, had a totally different growing up experience because he grew up in the South mm-hmm. at a time when black boys was very unlikely for them to grow up to be black men mm-hmm. Because there was so much violence associated mm-hmm. with being black in the Deep South. Mm-hmm. But his perspective was, you don't interact with white people at all. If you have to work with them, fine, you work with them, but you don't go to their houses, you don't make friends with them, you know, you stick with your own people. And so
that's called man principles.
Yes, right. And so I grew up in a household with 9 siblings and a mom and dad that had radically different.
We had 9 siblings too.
Yeah. Oh, you too?
I'm the 7th of 9.
You're the 7th of 9. I am the 6th of 9.
Uh-huh.
And so growing up, hearing these very different mm-hmm. perspectives of how we were supposed to be, I think it was left to all of us to figure out how are we going to process ourselves into the world, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I took my mom's perspective is that people are basically good and, you know, be open and meet people from wherever they are, right? Mm-hmm. And I love that I had both sides growing up, but then chose my path like you, right? Decided I would have a path that would be multicultural, multi-ethnic. And of course, having the experience of being in the Navy mm-hmm. at a young age mm-hmm. and being able to travel to different countries, I think just really solidified in me this knowledge that people are basically good. Mm-hmm. Because I've been in so many different places and so many different situations where strangers have been very gracious and kind right. when they didn't have to be. And so I go through the world assuming good, right? But I also can't ignore the hatred that's all around me. I can't ignore when I, you know, hear about what's happening to school children. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are many of us that are struggling. What do you do, you know? If you believe that people are basically good, mm-hmm. but yet you're hearing constantly that these things are happening, mm-hmm. you know, how do you balance that, right? And how do you keep your faith that people are basically good?
I was doing a class at Eastern Mennonite University on strategies of trauma awareness and resilience.
Right.
And one of the key things that this professor talked about was historical trauma.
Trauma, yes.
And then he talked about, I think something funny, he talked of Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, and institutions that were formed way back during civilization.
Right.
And it's like, how did they come up with their principles?
Right.
They were hitting on something they were against for.
Right.
And so by hitting on something they were against for, they did not have time to look at learning from that
right.
and moving on.
Right.
They looked at this is the better way to go and we focus going.
Right.
And so since there's a disconnect of learning from what they were looking at, there's kind of a lot of trauma they carried along, which is passed all along.
Yes.
And that keeps me thinking, even as peace builders, we still have a hard time to look at, like questions you're saying.
Right,
it's so hard. How do I ignore what's happening in the society?
Right.
But still, do we ever look back and look at really what happened?
Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about?
Right.
Because as much as the way you look at it, the opponent is a very bad and evil person.
Yes.
But that might not be necessarily true.
They're
also probably struggling.
Yes.
And being in the role of a victim, they play an aggressor role.
Yes.
And so they attack.
Yes.
And so having that in our minds mm-hmm. gives us a platform of looking at, okay, it's difficult, but we have to go back.
Right.
Let's just look at how did you get yourself here?
That's right. Right.
That's a mess we need to clean, which is, it's not just America. It's a global issue.
It's a global issue.
We are struggling, all of us.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm going to be in tears. Stop. Cut that out. We are. I think you're absolutely right. We are all struggling with that. And the idea of, we have just started talking about the idea of intergenerational trauma. Right, the trauma that we've just carried from one generation to the next mm-hmm. And as you said, because we haven't actually gone back and unpacked what happened in the past, mm-hmm. And either accepted our responsibility for our part, mm-hmm. Or acknowledging where we didn't have power to make the changes happen, yeah. Right? I think that that's a constant a challenge. What do we tell the children? What do we tell the children today? How do we prepare them so that... so that the next generation isn't still dealing with the issues that this generation and previous generations have dealt with?
In Kenya, we have a program for the school children called Helping Increase Peace Program.
Helping?
Increase Peace Program.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's basically small peace activities of tools that we use in peace work in other programs.
Right.
But they're more participatory and more engaging, things like drawings and focusing. But just how much lesson do we have in school on peace?
Right.
We
right.
need to start right. talking about that. We need to start talking about love. We need to look at kids, because any child in the U.S., 3 years old, right. if you put all of them together,
right.
they don't know color.
Right, they don't, right.
You have color in your head, they don't
right,
know that.
Right.
And so if we encourage our teachers to look at, have also increasing, it's not about academic performance, it's also about the social construction.
Yes, yes.
If you build our children in a social, constructive and positive living,
right.
They'll just take it better.
Right.
They'll leave saying, you know, right. what their parents tell them is not really,
yes.
they have something in school.
Right.
And so, because even our parents, as parents, we incite our children not because we love to do that, but we are hurting.
Right.
We are not dealing with our pain.
Right.
And we're just passing our pain to these innocent
yes.
people.
Yes.
So just having talks of peace, activities of peace,
right.
festival,
right.
discussion on peace, kids will just grow up knowing this is what should be happening.
Right. And of course, the younger we start, the more
the
they grow up with that
yeah.
mindset, right? We have a caller on the line. Good morning. I'm sorry, I didn't get the name.
Camilla.
Good morning. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Hi. I've got a question I'd like to hear the two of you discuss. Joanne, you mentioned that when you went to Kenya, you saw a sea of black people and had a very different experience from what you were used to growing up in the South. And I wonder if it might not be worthwhile to discuss some of the differences between people who have grown up in colonies that were ruled by the British versus the experience of people in the American South. My family is from Trinidad and Tobago, and I mean, there is a sort of dual legacy of British colonialism. On the one hand, you know, we saw the same oppression that people of color have seen all over.
Right.
But they also provided a certain set of standards, education, certain set of values, and it was a majority people of color population. So there was certainly racism, but there was still a sense that black people had certain entitlements, different from that in the South. So I wonder if the two of you might sort of compare those different kinds of inheritances and how that contributes to the differences that you may have seen due to that.
Well, thank you for the question. We will go there.
Yeah.
Have a good day. Appreciate the call.
Okay.
Interesting question, and I think the similarities are is that the city I grew up in, Baltimore, was 80% black when I grew up, and so everybody in every walk of life pretty much looked like me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't grow up with this sense of I couldn't do something because of my color, right? Uh-huh. Because, you know, whether it was the teachers or the police officer, the business owner, pretty much most folks mm-hmm. that I interacted with were Black. Mm-hmm. There were exceptions. We had a Jewish population that pretty much were the small business owners mm-hmm. throughout the Baltimore metropolitan area when I grew mm-hmm. up. And so I think we share the fact that we both started life in an environment that was Black.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you and I actually had very similar experiences. We grew up in communities where the community was responsible for the children, mm-hmm. right? We grew up in communities where you didn't have to know the adult to know mm-hmm. that adult felt a responsibility, and if you didn't do what you were supposed to do, they were going to tell mm-hmm. your parents or somebody else in your mm-hmm. in your family, right?
Mm-hmm.
What else?
I think, for me, in Kenya, it was colonized by British. And being colonized by British, one thing that the first president, Jomo Kenyatta, did was to not face their colony with hate.
Ah.
But he opened up, and that was the quick beginning of missionary, and education started. And yes, our children in school are taught about where they came from, the colony life and what happened. But right now, it's not like brought up as an issue. But within the powerful communities, which is the Kalenjin and the Kikuyu and the Luo community, who feel they played a major role in freedom fighting, they still hold some of their pride, saying mm-hmm. we own the country because we did this.
Right.
But just it becomes so difficult for the three of them to understand each other rather than the other small tribes. So that gives us an opportunity to negotiate, right?
Mm-hmm.
We kind of look at, okay, right now we are more focused on what's more important.
Right.
Rather than, do you want to go back to where we were?
Right.
And there's a lot of loud voices if the British wants to get involved in issues concerning Kenya. And mm-hmm. I think it's going to a place that, I don't know if it's the best place, but we are going to a place that we are more louder.
Mm-hmm.
And more sensitive mm-hmm. on the involvement of the outside world,
mm-hmm.
but still we support and work together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so cautiously optimistic about some of that support coming in, right?
Yeah.
But mindful of how it could go wrong.
Wrong.
Right? Very quickly, right?
Yeah,
if
exactly.
you're not paying attention. And I think, quite frankly, for folks here in the U.S., this last election cycle was a wake-up call for many middle-class white Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I compare it to what was happening during the Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm.
Once we started on the evening news every night showing the pictures of just the brutality that was mm-hmm. being rained down on Black people seeking equality,
mm-hmm.
Once people could no longer pretend they didn't know it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
It was coming into their living room every night. It was on the front page of the newspapers. People had to do something,
yeah.
right? Which is why I go back to, I think people are basically good,
yeah.
right? Because it's one thing to have blinders on, but once the blinders have been ripped away, mm-hmm. you have to do something.
Exactly.
And so here in the U.S. now, there have been thousands of new groups that have formed since the election. And people are motivated and energized to mm-hmm. do something. I think the problem is that there's not a unifying call for people to do something, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I've got my group here and my group, we decided we're going to do X, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so my group gets together monthly and this is what we work on, right? But what we don't know is that there are 20 other groups that are working on the exact same issue.
Mm-hmm.
And had we convened them all, we'd have much more power because there'd be many more people involved and engaged in that particular issue, right?
And I think that's why you need the radio services more, because
yes.
then you need to tell people what's going on and let people come up and say, this is our plan, and so how are we pulling this together? I mean, one thing that I realized for us that worked strongly is after the election violence, we focused on reconciliation and healing. Yes, we wanted to know the perpetrators.
Yes.
And there was the International Criminal Courts coming in to
yes.
find out and investigate, and there are some people who are suspected and taken into questioning for questioning on something.
Right.
But then we looked at, some of us were doing grassroots work, we looked beyond the election process. And now the whole thing is not even about investigating on the election, but it's more on looking at how community has been existing and what are the learning process from that.
Right.
And so probably that's again another thing for the US. Like, whatever might have happened to election, we have a president, we have a country to run, we have children who need to survive.
Right.
But let's look beyond the election and just look at what happened, what do we need, what lessons are we learning from it? Because probably it was meant to happen for us to realize where we are.
That's right. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, I think it's going to take a little bit more for our political parties to really honestly do that self-assessment. Because, you know, the party that lost or that got the popular vote but did not win the Electoral College, which is another thing that we have that's very, very bizarre, very unique in the world, right?
Yeah.
To have this little group of people decide after everybody votes. But I think our parties really don't do a good job of assessing what they did well and what they didn't do well. And I think it's going to take us a while to get those parties in shape. But you bring me hope, because what I realize and what I've always known is it will take people at the grassroots level and the power from the grassroots to really move what needs to take place at the national level.
And that's nonviolent direct action.
And that is, yes, nonviolent direct action. And it's always, and it's also, I love teaching the kids young so that they grow up with this mindset so that they are better decision makers and problem solvers when they're adults than we are, right? Because we haven't learned our lessons that violence begets more violence and peace begets more peace. So it's, you know, it's a really simple concept. And so we're down to about 5 minutes. How do people support the work that you're doing in Kenya if they want to? Do you have a website or a Facebook page or something like that?
We have, if they click African Great Lakes Initiative and they go to Kenya, they'll see our website is there. African Great Lakes Initiative is a nonprofit in St. Louis.
Okay.
Of Friends Peace Teams. And that's where we put our reports and work there, and they can learn on how to support our work.
Well, I'll get that information and post it on my Facebook page for people who want more information and want to connect with the work that you're doing. I think you're doing some incredibly necessary, powerful work. And I thank you so much for coming to Oregon and your U.S. travels and spending a week with us and sharing your experience. And I want to remind folks that tomorrow evening, there will be a potluck starting at 6 and a talk at 7 at Multnomah Friends Meeting House. And the title is Healing and Rebuilding Our Communities, Lessons from Kenya. And I want to encourage people, if you have ever get the opportunity to visit Kenya, you should on it. You should jump on it, because it is one of the most beautiful places on the planet. And every place I went, people were very welcoming and very and wanting to know all about me and why I was there. And it was just absolutely a fabulous experience. And I have to go back. I have to go back. I will
Please
go back.
Come.
I think I've got, we got one more caller. We're going to squeak in. Good morning, Karen. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I am just so honored with this guest you have. I hope I say her name right, Jetri.
Yeah,
you got it.
I'm Karen, and I was born in Sweden, but I lived in Kenya, and it was the best year of my life. I'm 55 now.
Thank you.
So this was in 1980, and Daniel, President Era Moi, was the president, and I wish we could copy some of what the Kenyans, you know, they, it seemed like there was so much respect and honor for the president. And I also know they're a very godly nation, Kenya, Christian nation. But no matter what our beliefs are, I believe the president is put here by God, and I would love to see an end to all this disunity and violence. Even I'm here in Portland, where there's so much, you know, the demonstrations and all.
Yeah. Well, demonstrations are healthy, but I absolutely agree the violence is very unhealthy.
Yeah.
Protest is part of our culture, part of our tradition. Violence isn't. Hate isn't.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But can I ask, there was a movie, and I don't know if, Jetri, if you know of this one, but it's called The Power of One. Have you, any of you heard
yes,
of this
I have.
Movie?
I have heard of that, yes.
And it's a beautiful story of coming together, mm-hmm. and that there's more power, just like the movie says, The Power of One.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's we have to figure out how to do that. We have to figure out how to have conversations with people that we don't agree with about everything.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't have to agree about everything to have a conversation, to be civil. For me, I like asking yeah. questions from people that I don't agree with because I learn something. Mm-hmm. It may not change my opinion.
Yeah.
But at least makes me understand why the other person feels the way they do,
exactly.
right? And everybody has the right to their own feelings, but people don't have the right to espouse hate
yeah.
and violence and to treat people disrespectfully mm-hmm. because they look different, they dress different, they have different cultural norms. That is not okay. And that is not American. And unfortunately, we have a president who is articulating those kind of really horrendous views. And so, and I think that's what's giving other people permission to spread that hate and nastiness.
And I guess that's where I may differ because I am not political. I actually didn't choose one side or the other this year.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess personally, I have not seen that in him. I see that he's surrounded by people who want the best for America. And that he, when I hear him, I think he's leading with love. And I don't hear him speak hate, but I think that there are so many different different places that where I do hear just all those opposing sides, and I think we need to have love and come back to our faith, you know, or we need to come back to just love
yeah.
for people, no matter how the differences.
Yes, and I just want to say I really appreciate you calling today, and even though you and I are on different sides of this coin, I am grateful for your call, and I appreciate your message. Have a great
Thank
day.
Thank you, Joanne, for all you do. Okay.
Thank you. Take care. We're going to squeak in another caller. We can get... Good morning, Francis. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Hi. I appreciate your conversation this morning.
Thank you.
And I just have a point to make. Mm-hmm. We talk about differences of opinion. And to me, someone's rights and whether or not they're being oppressed, that's not a matter of discussion, as
right.
far as I'm concerned. There isn't a side to that.
Yes,
people's
right.
human rights are human rights, and they need to be respected by everyone, including the authorities. And when we get into these, call these conversations political debates, to me it's suggesting that whether or not someone's human rights and civil rights should be respected is a matter of discussion. And it is not.
Well, but, and you know, every time we vote on whether or not someone should have civil rights, it mm-hmm. always goes bad, right? And we
right.
end up having to change it,
yeah.
right? Because that should never be up for a vote.
It's
absolutely,
not a matter of discussion.
Right.
There's
and
no,
it, right. And there's
to
no.
To oppress people is right. not an opinion or a right or a freedom of speech. To dispute hate is not.
We're with you, Francis.
All right, you guys take care.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Bye
now. We have less than a minute to go, but I think we might be able to squeak in this last caller. Maybe. If not, I just want to remind folks that Friday, June 19th, tomorrow, 6 p.m. will be the potluck, 7 p.m. will be the program, Healing and Rebuilding Our Communities. It has been such a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you.
We are blessed to have you in our community, and you walk in a peaceful way. So it's really wonderful. I just feel the calm. You come mm-hmm. with calm, right? And so we appreciate you being here. Congratulations on the fine work that you're doing. And I want you to know that NAACP Portland, mm-hmm. we did a series of videos that will be posted on our website soon. And they're all like 7 or 10 minute videos mm-hmm. about nonviolence. So different pieces that
That's
might
nice.
Be very helpful to your work.
I love it.
This Thank has you. Been Voices from the Edge, and we'll see you next week, same time, same place, same station. And thank you so much, John, for making us sound good.
Thank you. Bye.
Have a great day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 8:59, and Press Watch is next. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on Between the Covers, Ken Jones talks to blogger, journalist, and author Cory Doctorow about his new novel, Walkaway, that envisions a future where civilians can simply walk away from society and are able to use computer-printed food, clothing, and shelter. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not one, please become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. It's 8:59.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2017 Juneteenth Celebration on Saturday, June 17th in Foster Hall at Clark College, Vancouver, Washington. Juneteenth, aka Freedom Day or Emancipation Day, is a holiday commemorating the abolition of slavery in the state of Texas some 2 years after slavery was abolished. The Juneteenth celebration will feature African dance, speakers, music, food, a pie contest, and more. Again, that's the 2017 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 17th in Foster Hall at Clark College, 1933 Fort Vancouver Way in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.